So how long is 3 minutes? Well, it's about the recommended cooking time for a toasted cheese sandwich. But for those of you who think in pages, think of a single A4 page Times New Roman 12-point type, standard margins. It's actually hard enough to keep to 3 minutes when you only know a little bit about your topic. But it's incredibly difficult to know your topic so thoroughly that you can whittle it down without mauling it to death. But that's exactly what every one of the 10 finalists in Brisbane last year did. They were fiercely intelligent, they were highly entertaining, and they were absolutely compelling. And as the session wore on, I admit it, I found myself getting just a little bit resentful. Couldn't just one of those presentations be a little less worthy of winning, so it wouldn't be so impossible to judge? But no one obliged. No, they were determined to be uniformly brilliant. Darn them. But I suppressed that unworthy and ignoble thought. I said to myself, Alan, you're the chief scientist. Just be grateful that those people are advancing knowledge instead of being lawyers billing their clients in 3 minute increments. Be grateful that they're doing PhDs. And that got me thinking about the question that brings us here today. Let's assume that in every generation, we get a certain cohort of talented, driven people. And in this generation, we know that many of those people will choose to do a PhD. And so, to everyone here today, that is an enormous vote of confidence in the value of what you do and the integrity with which you do it. And by any measure, it's an enormous investment of our society's potential. So the question always has to weigh on us. What does it mean to be worthy custodians? And this conference will consider that challenge in its many facets. And today, I want to talk about the foundation, culture, and ethos. I want to reflect on what it means to be a 21st century scientist. And in the traditional way, I have framed my thoughts as the advice that I would give to you, the PhD students in the audience today, striving to excel. Now, I know that advice, unlike funding, is one of the very few things the PhD students tend to get in abundance. This year, in particular, I've seen many articles to the effect that science is broken, and that the best advice you can give somebody who is contemplating a PhD is, don't do it. But that will not be my advice. First, I reject the hypothesis that science is broken. It suggests that science was somehow not broken, or at least significantly better, at some point in the past. And I just don't see it. Point me to the period in human history where we had more brilliant people or better technologies for doing science than we do today. I agree, we certainly have our frustrations like every other profession. But point me to the era where scientists were always courteous to their colleagues and good at explaining themselves to other people and were all given the support that they could possibly need to pursue rich personal lives alongside stellar academic careers. Point me to the world where science was open to people of all backgrounds and science was not misused by people with bad intentions. Point me to the society where evidence always ruled the public discussion, and every time a scientist spoke, the news cycle stopped so that the journalists would have time to pay attention. That golden age of science, it never existed. The only place to find it is in the future. So let's not tell you young scientists that science is broken. Let's encourage you to help us to make it better. The second reason I reject the avoid at all costs school of advice is that I see so many ways that science delivers the goods. And here's just one. One of the most helpful things about being a modern human being is satellite navigation. Well, satellite navigation is basically just clocks in space. Atomic clocks on satellites, calibrated against the atomic clocks in the National Standards Laboratories. They are extremely accurate. But if you've tried to navigate with your smartphone in inner city Sydney, you'll suffer from the problem called multipath interference. Signals bouncing between the buildings causing such havoc that poor old Google loses it. And reasonably accurate won't be good enough for a city of self-driving cars. Just imagine it. The solution is to install an atomic clock in every car and smartphone satellite navigation system. But today, those clocks are monsters. The best ones fill up rooms. But what if we could shrink atomic clocks down to the size of a computer chip so that we could actually embed them inside smartphones? Well, that's exactly what researchers today are working on. Instead of tapping an oscillating atom in a giant vacuum chamber, they have trapped it in a tiny atomic cage. That is a single spherical molecule of carbon with 60 atoms. It would properly be named a fullerene, informally known as a buckyball, after Buckminster Fuller, the architect who developed the geodesic dome. That single carbon molecule encases a single nitrogen atom, and it protects it from the environment. And then that single nitrogen atom is stimulated by a laser beam so that it oscillates at its so-called resonant frequency. And presto, you have a microscopic atomic clock. That's science doing its thing. It started with an idea put forth by Lord Kelvin in 1879. And it was 70 years later that the first atomic clock was built in 1949. And then another 70 years to go from a monster to a molecule. The space age and the information age bound up in one. And I look at something so astonishing, and it seems to me that anybody with a pulse should be excited by the possibilities of science in 2018. Of course people want to do research. They should want to do research. And if they have the passion and the talent to undertake a PhD, then who am I to dissuade them? So, in that spirit, my advice to the next generation. First principle, you need a relentless commitment to quality. I was lucky personally to train under a great scientist, Professor Steve Redman. These days, we would describe Steve as unproductive. He published at most two or three papers a year. But every one of those papers was deeply considered, included both hypothesis and the supporting data, was meticulously crafted, and as a result, every one of those papers was deeply influential. The quality of the papers was simply the mark of the way Steve managed every aspect of his research, right down to building the research equipment. So in everything, quality first. These days, the pressures and incentives are very different. We have a whole taxonomy of the ways that systems can encourage or enable good scientists to go wrong. Harking. Has anybody heard of harking? That's creating a hypothesis after the results are known, or known, so you can get harking. P-hacking, that's torturing your data until it screams. the file drawer effect, selectively publishing only the interesting data, and pseudo-collaboration, assigning credit where credit is not due. That's assigning credit to the so-called non-contributing authors. I know, it's an oxymoron, but we all know it's been done. Now, only academics could develop such a comprehensive field guide for misbehaviour. These range from the inadvertent to the deliberate. I urge you, look up these clever ways to do bad science and know thy enemy, because it would be naive to suggest that the pressures aren't real, or that only bad people fall prey to them. The lesson that I take from Steve Redman is that we all need to commit to quality, consciously and constantly. It's not necessarily instinctive, but it does need to be ingrained. Your PhD training program should teach research quality through specific coursework. In everything, quality first. Of course, it's much easier to be relentlessly committed to quality if you're doing something that you love. And that brings me to the second principle: know your limitations. I had a very enjoyable time as a young researcher making the electronic machines that would enable me to monitor the electronic activity in snail brains. I kid you not, my research model was snail brains. But I couldn't help noticing that my own brain wasn't wired like the brains of the people around me. They got excited by their results. I didn't really care about the results. I can't explain it. I just wanted to make the machine for running the experiment, and then to make it better and better again. So I realised that I had a choice. I could either be a deeply unfulfilled scientist or a passionate engineer, making it possible for other scientists to make important discoveries. I chose the latter. But first, I had to redefine my difference from the scientists around me. Not as a weakness, but in another context, something that could be a strength. And it goes a little bit, Tanya, to what you were talking about. Today, I have no patience for people who tell me that a person with a PhD who starts a company or goes into the public service is a waste of a good academic career. The purpose of a PhD is to allow talented people to develop their strengths and choose their own direction. I was lucky, again, to have the guidance of exceptional colleagues and mentors, some of them researchers, some of them experienced business persons. But that was the sort of luck that I made for myself. I sought out those people who I knew I could trust their advice. And that brings me to principle number three: to be a generous listener and sharer. We've told ourselves for eons that science has a problem with silos. And as chief scientist, I have a bird's eye perspective. I've met scientists from the same university, the same department, sometimes even in the same corridor, who have simply never spoken. So much of my work is matchmaking. But I have the benefit of distance. From a distance, you can often see the patterns that are hidden from the people who are working up close. I know that for PhD students in particular, the research life can be isolating, anxious, and all-absorbing. We need to encourage the habit of conversation, not as a sideline, but as simply what good scientists do. And that doesn't mean that it happens by default. Like committing to quality, it has to be a conscious choice. So go to seminars, speak to the speaker, speak to the attendees, walk the corridors and see not just what is there, but who is there. The payoff for a young researcher who makes that commitment is good advice, and just as importantly, new opportunities. Which brings me to principle four: be open to opportunities. The Nobel laureate Richard Feynman had a nugget of wisdom that he would hand out freely to young researchers. And he would say, come up with a list of your 12 favourite problems and then keep them constantly in your mind. Keep them present, but dormant. And then every time you come across a new research tool or an interesting discovery, test it against your 12 problems and see if that new discovery will help. And it's amazing, he said, how many people and will marvel and say, he's a genius, if you just look methodically for opportunities. Feynman's advice is an application of an old maxim that I took with me when I left Australia to start my company, Axon Instruments, in California. It's well known, chance comes to the prepared mind. And these days, I prepare my mind to look for people with interesting stories. And it's amazing. I never meet a person who hasn't got one. In the last month alone, I've met with the founders of Gilmore Space. Two founders. One was a banker for 20 years, and the other was a marketing graduate. Now they've raised $5 million to launch small satellites into low Earth orbit using the world's largest hybrid rocket engine. This is up in Brisbane. I met with the founders of Tritium, and they got their start in the World University Solar Car Challenge. Now they employ 130 people making quick charges for electric vehicles. And those charges are lining highways all over the world. I spoke just last week at a forum on the same day as Dr. Catherine Ball. She completed a PhD in spatial ecology. Now, she's a leader for the global Drones for Good movement, focused on the use of drones for humanitarian work. She's the co-founder of the first global drone conference. And in her spare time, still on the theme, she's on a mission to give 100,000 women and girls in Australia the opportunity to fly a drone by 2020. It seems to me that very few people get to interesting places by doing conventional things. No, they get there on the trail of opportunity. So, those four pieces of advice again. First, a relentless commitment to quality. Second, know your own limitations. Third, be a generous listener and sharer. And fourth, keep those doors of opportunity open. Which brings me to the opportunity presented by this conference. And now I'm speaking to everyone here today. You're here because you care about research. So let's use this conference to think about how we can all inch our research activity closer to that future golden age. And I'm going to follow my own advice and take a cue from Richard Feynman. And in that spirit, I'm going to set out a few big questions. And I'm asking everyone here to test out the ideas and approaches that you encounter over the next few days to see if they advance us any further in solving them. So here, in no particular order, are some of the things that I've been thinking about. I'll give you five. And the first is the future of the scientific paper. Last week, The Atlantic magazine published a provocative essay titled, "The Scientific Paper is Obsolete." Now, the scientific paper has done great things since it was developed in the 1600s. And today, we could certainly say that production, it's booming. But we produce a lot more papers than there are expert and available peer reviewers. Page charges are high, and so the critically important methods section, it gets left out. Alternatives pop up overnight because the barriers to entry, they're low. One has to ask, it's an obvious question, have we hit peak paper? My tentative response is no. The scientific paper has endured for a reason, and that reason still holds. It is an efficient way to structure and communicate information. But what do you think? Will we still be publishing papers in 2050? And if not, how else could we share information? Second, the pressure to publish. I spoke earlier on of my unproductive supervisor, Professor Steve Redman. I think that we could all agree that publishing a few articles a year, actually, it's the ideal. Authors could invest more time in their papers, and peer reviewers could invest more time in their critiques. In the real world, we know that the incentives, they often skew the other way. The peer review system, it is critically overloaded. And the irony is, we're working so hard to generate papers that we hardly have time for reading other people's papers. But where do you intervene to break this cycle? I recently saw a radical suggestion. Every researcher should be given a lifetime word limit. I suspect it would be very difficult to enforce. But seriously, what about a variation? Change the focus from publications to the CVs. And for starters, let's contemplate a rule that you can only list a maximum of 5 papers for any given year when you're applying for grants or promotions. And that's quite a difference to what I often see, which is long CVs that have 30, 40, or 50 papers published per year. In addition, your CV would have to list retractions with an explanation. And on the recommendation of Jeffrey Flyer, the former dean of the Harvard Medical School, candidates for promotion would have to critically assess their own work, including unanswered questions, controversies, and uncertainties. Okay, that's one to consider, shifting that focus from publications to what is on your CV. Third, better incentives for thankless work. Should we have dedicated funding for replication studies? Should we consider awards for high-quality studies that yield negative results and don't confirm a hypothesis or previous finding? It's been tried in some disciplines, but could it be done at scale? Fourth question, about predatory journals. If journals are the gatekeepers, then predatory journals, they are the termites that eat the gates and make the community question the integrity of the structure. How do we fight back? And how do we arm people in the community who aren't scientists and who don't know anything about impact factors and journal rankings and editorial standards? How do we train them to recognise quality? Think about this. Could we have an analogy to fair trade coffee? A stamp that consumers can look for on the product that demonstrates that it complies with a certain standard. Could we promote an ethical journal stamp, a stamp of quality for our journals? Last one to think about, artificial intelligence. Bloomberg recently reported that there are now 5 ways to command a multi-year 7-figure salary. If you can't do the numbers, 7 figures, that's $1 million salary. There used to be only 4 ways: CEOs, banker, celebrity entertainer, or professional athlete. The recently added 5th is a person with a PhD in artificial intelligence. This is the AI century. Like all great ways in technology, it breaks on researchers first. Time and time again, You get the future. You make the future. You get it before it sweeps over everyone else. But what does that mean for research training? What roles do scientists do today will robots do today? What roles that no one can do today will become possible with the power of humans and robots combined? It's an intriguing question, and one that lends itself to many wonderful, insightful PhDs. Perhaps there is one in your future with your name on it. But I am well beyond the 3-minute mark. So let me conclude with the immortal words of the immortal doctor, by whom I mean, of course, Doctor Who. A straight line may be the shortest distance between two points, but it is by no means the most interesting. So I say, enjoy the conference and keep it interesting. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Alan. That was both informative and entertaining, two things which don't always go together. So thank you. Thank you very much. We've got about, checking my non-atomic clock. We've got about 25 minutes for questions from the floor. There are a couple of people with microphones at the back who will come to you. So do we have a first question? We have one at the back.
You don't have to.
No, it's okay. It's when the tea's ready.
Thank you very much for your speech. It was incredibly inspiring. As a mature PhD student who has a career already established, but I've gone back to do a PhD because I can, and I also do some consulting for a journal, and I watch with interest politics that it happens around me, not only amongst my colleagues but also amongst the academics that I trust to help me get to where I need to go. Your 5 points were really interesting, and I thought they were fabulous because the publish or perish has been the nightmare of many and the breaker of many. How do we get our universities to take on some of those more sustainable practices?
It's hard to see the universities doing it voluntarily. It's a competitive world out there. I think it is something. Let me just recap on the problems. The first is that quantity and quality, they both start with Q and they get confused. And so people chase quantity as much as they chase quality. And the best of the researchers can often deliver both. But if you're doing 50 papers a year, it's hard to do the kind of quality that I was referring to when I talked about Steve Redman. And when I talked about him being unproductive, I was not being rude, I was being complimentary because of the quality of each of his papers. So people do get confused by that as the researchers who are chasing the quantity, as much as people who haven't got the time to dive into a CV and say, oh my God, this person published 500 papers in 25 years, they must be a genius. It's hard to get away from that. I think that the grant agencies have an extraordinary opportunity. They already are smart enough to say, typically list your 5 best papers in the body of a grant or body of a prize award. But of course, you're invited to put your full CV in. And I think there should just be a rule, and I've not gone and researched this line of thinking. It's a proposal. It's not something that I'm going to agitate for. But it'd be worth considering saying, you can only ever put into a long CV 5 papers a year. You get to choose. Universities, perhaps as a little bit nudged by the grant-giving authorities, could do the same for promotions. You can only list 5 CVs in your promotion application, 5 per year. If they don't do it on their own volition, maybe they could be encouraged by the grant authorities. I think 5 papers per year would be much, much easier to enforced than a lifetime word limit, which, by the way, was in a Nature magazine perspective just a few weeks ago as a suggestion, but acknowledged to be difficult because of so many reasons. The other thing is predatory journals and just bad journals. Predatory are the evil journals that take your money and with a computer publish your papers on a website irrespective of the fact that they promise peer review and there is no such thing in their minds. But they're also just bad journals. Wouldn't it be great if through a process, journals that followed a ethical set of principles, and there is a society called COPE, the Committee of Publishing Ethics, which does have, I think, about 1,000 journals in its membership. But wouldn't it be great if there was a stamp, just like a fair trade stamp, that meant that you adhere to certain criteria as a journal when taking papers, such as expecting that every author has signed a stat deck to say that they've contributed? Because you actually hear about one of the practices I was talking about, the co-publishing, where people say, look, you're about to publish a paper all by yourself, I'm about to publish a paper all by myself, I didn't help you, you didn't help me, but we're friends. You put me on as a co-author and I'll put you on as a co-author and we get two publications on our CV. Well, journals should be testing for that through at least the requirement for a statutory declaration. So there are many things that could be done through a voluntary system of journals getting together and through the adoption of practices through the granting agencies either here or around the world. But it's more difficult for universities that are competing for staff. But some could do it and should.
Can I just take that a bit further? One of the things that worries me is the thing about quantity and research integrity. Because when you have people that have 25 or 50 publications a year, I just physically find it hard to believe that they have had time to read all those publications or to contribute. Because those people normally have very high-powered jobs, very busy labs. So how have they had the time to truly contribute?
No, it's difficult to see. I do know some who are spectacularly successful researchers, and in their unique circumstances, I'll credit that they somehow managed to do it. But in the majority of cases, they can't. And let me take Steve Redman again as an example. He supervised me through my PhD, and I had a couple of papers in the Journal of Physiology, which was one of the most prestigious journals at that time. And he insisted that I be sole author. He could have easily been Finkel and Redman. We did some other papers that we did do research on together as Redman and Finkel and Finkel and Redman. But even though he supervised me for too many years and was intimately involved in everything I was doing, he felt it appropriate not to be an author because he didn't contribute to the research. He was my mentor, not a co-author. I'm not sure how many lead scientists in a lab or supervisors would take that approach today. And I'm not passing a moral judgment. I truly am not, because there's good reason why somebody might put themselves in as the last author or whatever to indicate that they're the lab head. But it's partly driven by the desire to publish lots of papers, partly driven by the expectation of a recognition. Steve was recognised on my papers in the acknowledgement section. So there are many, many different pressures on people, and I agree that in some cases it's inconceivable that all of the authors will have either contributed or read all of the paper. And you just read horror stories from time to time. There was one last year where a paper had to get retracted. There were only two authors, and the senior author, his excuse was, I didn't look at the data because that was on the computer of the junior author, and she was in Paris and I was in, I think, Stockholm. It was a European thing. Well, that's a terrible excuse. I think there was more embarrassment by him giving the excuse than by having to retract the paper.
Just one there. Hi. Thank you again. It was a wonderful speech. I have a question that's on a slightly different slant, and that's the quality... the ability, new disciplines. So, for instance, my area is human aspects of cybersecurity. Well, everything's on the quality of the journal you're publishing in. Everyone has to get an A star or an A journal, that sort of thing. Yet, my discipline is so young that the highest ranking journal is a B. And how do we get the ability to allow new disciplines to move up that quality ranking ladder for recognition when we're sort of stuck on old planes of this is what are the quality journals?
I think that a lot of the attention has dissipated and gone away from impact factor. I'm really trying to concentrate in what I've been talking about as the things that ensure really high standards, irrespective of whether the journal has a high impact factor or low. But going to your specific question, I don't know. Disciplines grow, and cybersecurity is one of those disciplines that's growing very, very rapidly. And I think if you're publishing in the best journal in that field, you should be very proud of that. It's just infrequent that you can get a paper in Nature or Science or one of those ultra-high impact factor generalised journals. If you can, fantastic, but I'd be very proud if I was you if you're publishing in one of the highly regarded journals in that field. And by the way, I owe you all an explanation. I kept referring to science because of where I come from rather than research, but I use science in the original sense of scientia, that's knowledge. So when I'm using science, it's sort of interchangeable with research of any kind, except for law. No, I didn't say
that. Alan, it was lovely to hear you speak to the challenge we have around people that get PhDs and then find pathways outside academia. I find it immensely frustrating how such people often refer to themselves as failures. What can we do to change that narrative?
I think it's by speaking as we do. I've written about this often in op-eds and other speeches, and by the examples and the expectations that you and others give when people start. And you referred to the expectations they had, and I'm sure after they made this statement about wanting to be a professor just like you, you had a deep and meaningful... I'm serious, you would have had a deep and meaningful discussion with them. In a review that was done for the Department of Education by ACOLA, the Australian Council of Learned Academies, that's the Academy of Science, Academy of Humanities and Social Sciences... Arts, Humanities, Social Sciences and Engineering about 3 or 4 years ago into the research training scheme. There was a lot devoted in that review to the importance of a high integrity discussion with people before they even started their PhD. It's one thing to talk to them after they've enrolled and say, what do you want to do? I'm questioning exactly when you're speaking to them, Tanya, but that conversation should start with people beforehand, so that they understand the prospects. And then we need to celebrate the examples where people have made a conscious choice. So I find it very irritating to read a review in a paper or a result in a paper from a survey that says, OMG, oh my gosh, only 46% of STEM graduates got a job in a STEM field. It's ludicrous. You wouldn't say that about arts graduates. You wouldn't even say it about law graduates. It's certain disciplines, clearly, people should expect to be working in that field. Medicine, dentistry, and a few others like that. But even other professions like law, only about 1 in 8 law graduates in the long term is working in law. So why do we expect that a large majority of people who do a science degree, now I am talking about science, a science degree, should end up working in a science discipline? Whether you do arts, economics, or science, you're doing you're deep diving into a discipline. You're learning something really well, and you're honing your skills for learning. And once you've done it once, it's actually easy to do it again in the workplace. I've done it myself. You can pivot to a new discipline again and again. But if you haven't done it once, gosh, you'll find it difficult to do it in the workplace. I made a conscious choice. I wasn't thrown out of university. I was fortunate to have an ongoing postdoctoral appointment. But as I said in my speech, coming to understand my own proclivities, I decided to leave, go to America and start up a company making instruments that I was only able to make because of the work that I'd done in my PhD and my postdoc. So I leveraged that into a whole new opportunity for me going to business, and then, of course, branched into different areas later on. So, Tanya, I think the answer is that honest discussion in advance and celebrating those people who have gone off into other areas and speaking loudly to journalists in particular and politicians who challenge you about what's wrong with STEM disciplines. I am talking about STEM disciplines now because it's almost unique that they get criticised. What's wrong with the STEM disciplines, science, technology, engineering and mathematics, that only half of the people are getting STEM career jobs? It really doesn't matter what you do. As long as you learn to do it well and you're prepared to pivot, use the logic of your undergraduate degree or your PhD degree in whatever is the opportunity that finds you and that you enjoy.
Thank you for your presentation. We're seeing some compelling and concerning information come through about the mental health and well-being of our PhD candidates. And I'm wondering if you have any views on how elements of the research training ecosystem should be interpreting and responding to that.
So I must admit I have no specific awareness of that report, and I'm not in a PhD supervisor relationship. But when we talk about the skill set that people need to work or do a PhD, which is a form of work, the only difference is you don't get paid. We now recognise that you need the combination of discipline knowledge and what I tend to call enterprise skills. Enterprise skills are communication, clear thinking, resilience, project management, in the case of a PhD, lab ethics, lab strategies and things like that. I think there's an obligation on universities to increasingly include 2 or 3 months of coursework, and I do not mean discipline-specific coursework, but general coursework in a PhD, and one part of that extra coursework would be the resilience training that will help PhDs to tackle the problems that you're talking about.
Hi. Thank you for that speech. I'm a PhD candidate for Adelaide Uni. And just building up on what has been saying regarding the future of the career for the PhD students, I get really discouraged when I hear those things like, oh, you know, it is very unlikely that you get an academia position and things along those lines. My concern is I really want to keep researching the area that I'm researching. I want to keep going. You don't have enough time in 3 years to do further research. Whether it's in academia or in a private sector, you want to keep researching. What advice will you give to keep researchers researching and not leaving the field and leaving that area open?
My first one would be aware of how difficult it is, and it's true in anything. There's always a pyramid. In any kind of career opportunity, whether it's sport or in business. The numbers that I recall, and they might not be exactly right, is that for every 100 PhD graduates, about 40 go on to do a postdoc, about 4 get some kind of a tenured position, about 0.4 get a full professorial position. But it's not necessarily driven by just academic excellence. It's also driven by the passion. A lot, like myself, leave for other reasons. So I would just encourage you to achieve as much as you can, be out there talking to people, because the opportunities aren't necessarily in your university. They might not be in Australia, they could be anywhere. So go to conferences, go to seminars, talk to the speakers, talk to the attendees, follow your passion, and whatever you do, it's like the old song, do what you do, do well.
Hello, thank you for an inspiring opening. My question is about the role of philosophy of science in this debate, because it seems that at times we discuss, even the way we frame the discussion, is in the boundaries of an industry that publishes 2.5 million articles, papers per year. So to what extent philosophy of science is maybe absent from doctoral education and could extend the debate, not just on methodological level, but also ontological and epistemological.
So I think it goes back to what I was saying about coursework. So when I did my PhD, it was a classic Australian PhD a long time ago, absolutely no discussion, even with my supervisor, who I respect and I'm still very good friends with, there was no discussion about philosophy of science at all. I happened to be sharing a house with a fellow who was doing a teaching degree. He'd actually done a science degree, and then he was doing a master's in teaching. He was following Piaget and philosophy of science, and so that's where I got my first exposure to it. It's not taught, and it doesn't come naturally. You have to think about it. I mean, I mentioned Harking. Hypothesis asks for the results are known. Instinctively, it's not a bad thing to do. You do an experiment. You weren't sure exactly what your hypothesis was, or you had a hypothesis and didn't come out that way, but you saw something else, you got some results, and you need backfill to work out the hypothesis. It doesn't sound that bad, but it's well known from people having looked at it that it often leads to bad results, bad data, bad science, bad concepts. To the extent that the FDA, when you're submitting trial data, you can only submit data from a phase 2 and phase 3 trial where you specified in advance the expected outcomes, in advance of the trial. If during the trial you find, well, it didn't do your primary outcome, but you saw this other whiz-bang effect, say, on muscle strength, you can't say, look what we found, give us an approval for this drug to improve muscle strength. They'll say, no, go back and start again with that as your outcome and design the experiment for that, because statistics are such that things will happen. And that's why they talk about harping as well, torturing your statistics until they scream. So I guess my answer to your question is we've got to teach it. We've got to teach philosophy of science, because the ways that you can go wrong are often inadvertent. Of course, there's the deliberate, fraudulent activity that some people will undertake, and that happens in every profession. But the majority of problems in science are not fraud, it's flawed science, because the people undertaking the research didn't understand the basic approaches, and those basic approaches actually derive from understanding the philosophy of science, the nature of science turning over the previous theory with the latest results of the new theories coming in. So I think some proactive teaching.
One of the points that you made in your remarks about quality publications was the importance of quality reviewing. Now, I'm not sure what the situation is in Australian universities, but in South Africa, that's invisible academic work. And I'm wondering if there are any possibilities for universities considering making it a visible, acknowledged part of an academic's work, or if it's in a reviewer, perhaps outside of a university even, some way of making it possible for reviewers to devote more time to reviewing because it is part of their workload.
Look, I think that's a great idea. It would be up to the universities, perhaps with some guidance from the NHMRC and the ARC in Australia. I mean, it's certainly something you should put on your CV, being the editor of a journal or doing reviews. It's very credible, important work that's being done. One of the important things that would be a positive consequence of what I was recommending, which is to limit the number of papers that people would be encouraged to do in the course of a year, is that the burden on reviewers, on the reviewing system, would be dramatically reduced. There's just too many papers for the available number of reviewers. So the biggest problem is not, yes, there is a problem that you referred to, that the reviewers aren't getting appropriate credit. They may or may not get paid, but they're not necessarily getting the appropriate credit within the system. But it's also a huge problem that there's just too much to be done for little value, because the tail end of the papers that are being published, it's a long tail end. And ideally, a lot of them wouldn't be published. So multi-pronged.
Hello, Alan. I'm a PhD student from the University of South Australia. One of the big things I get advice for a lot now is our PhD students should have a startup company. But honestly, I have no idea how to do a startup company or how my research could apply to a startup company. So as someone who's kind of done it a little bit, what advice would you have for a PhD student to do it, and how do you think universities should train PhD students to start up companies?
That's a very, very fair question. Like so many things, it's not for everyone. So first, if for some reason you've got no interest in doing that, don't pursue it. But pretty much all the universities, I think University of South Australia and University of Adelaide and Flinders, in this state and around the country and in many countries around the world, are actively running entrepreneurial programs, entrepreneurial hubs, accelerators, and opportunities for people to learn how to do this. It sounds almost contradictory that you're going to teach somebody to be innovative or teach somebody to think outside the box. I mean, what is the specific thing that you teach them? The best way is to immerse them into an accelerator or an entrepreneurial hub so that they see what others are doing. It's the sort of stuff you tend to learn by osmosis. It's not the sort of stuff that you tend to learn as much by coursework. There's always some aspect of it you can learn by coursework, but if you're doing a PhD and you're enjoying what you're doing and you stay with that, so be it. But if you're trying to maximise the doors of opportunity, maybe you should explore visiting one of those accelerators, talking to a few people. Maybe something will excite you and you'll see something different that you want to do in life or after you do your PhD. I don't at all recommend that everybody should be encouraged to start a startup. If we were all running startups, how would we people, the big companies, and we need a lot of these big companies. Where would we get our public servants? But there is an increasing trend towards that, and it's great for the economy, it's great for many, many people, but it has to be something you enjoy. If you do enjoy it, I think the best way to do it is by immersing yourself and surrounding yourself and speaking to the people who are already doing it.
We probably have time for one quick question if anybody has one.
Thank you, Alan. You talked a number of times about predatory journals and the problem of ethics, but I'd just like to raise a kind of deeper question, because I think we've been looking at lots of surface level issues, and the deeper question is, you said science isn't broken, but is the logic of academic research broken? And I'm talking about the business model that underpins it, because I agree that predatory journals are the enemy, but at the moment, universities pay us money to produce knowledge and intellectual ideas, and then we give that away for free to academic publishers that then sell it back to our employers. So I'm just wondering whether you think there's room to disturb that business model, because I think it feeds into a lot of the problems about not enough reviewers, the peer review process is not good enough, people are feeling stressed and overworked, etc. And that's because the academic publishers are getting the economic rents from our intellectual labour.
Just one clarification, then answer your question. I didn't say that science is broken. I keep reading screaming headlines that science is broken, and my argument was that it's not. In terms of the publishing model, I think that there is no solution as long as the system is overloaded. And that's why I was going to what you might see as a surface approach, but I think that if you don't do something about taking away the quantity imperative, we're going to always be chasing our tails. We've gone from the exact model you described as being the only model, probably till the late 1990s, to open publishing and online publishing with post-event review, like the physics ArcX and things like that. With the additional requirement that in some countries, and we're still debating here what to do, after a certain amount of time, all journals have to make the papers freely available. Otherwise, people on a government grant can't submit to those journals. So it's a real problem that you've referred to, and there is no simple solution, but the alternatives that have been tried aren't all that successful, because when you go with open publishing, you lose the you can, you don't necessarily, but you can lose the reputational aspect that means that the editors take the job really seriously. You absolutely lower the barrier, almost to the point of eliminating the barrier for starting up a journal, and that's what lets the predatory journals in. I don't think that there is a single system that is optimal. I would like to see quite seriously, you know, a ethical journal stamp, whether it's voluntary or imposed through the granting agencies, that says that the only places that you'll consider a paper submitted for a grant as being worthy is if it was published in a journal that complies with these standards. We did it for coffee, we did it for, you know, for runners and shoes and things like that, and it makes a difference. And if it's not enough, then you bring in enforced requirements. But my simple answer is I don't think there is a single model of publishing that gets around the renting, the rent-seeking that you're talking about, without opening up the floodgates. Okay.
Thank you. I must draw the conversation to a close, but unfortunately, because I think there's... We could carry on for the whole conference, actually, just talking to Alan. Could I thank you very, very much? And could I give you...